On this eve of the 48th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, we will talk about the claims of conspiracy surrounding his death and how we should examine them. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, November the 21st. We will welcome in the author of the book, JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. And this is not only about JFK, but also other conspiracy theories like 9/11 and FDR and Pearl Harbor and others. And we will welcome your questions and your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is, and listeners will recognize this name, John McAdams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, author of JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. His Kennedy Assassination webpage is linked to our program notes, and we'll put it on the Facebook page as well. Professor McAdams, good morning.
Well, good morning to you.
Well, our listeners are used to hearing you talking about current political issues of the day. How did you get involved with writing about conspiracy theories?
In the early 1990s, when the movie JFK came out, I got kind of drawn into the discussion on an internet news group, and it's easy to get sucked in. It's easy to say, well, gosh, this is an interesting thing. That's an interesting thing. I want to get to the bottom of it. It's also the case that I like to think of myself as kind of a debunker by temperament. And there's a lot of nonsense about the JFK assassination. Frankly, I think most of the nonsense comes from conspiracists, although some lone assassin authors have done some things that I think are quite up to snuff intellectually also. But it's a very target-rich environment, as fighter pilots would say, a target-rich environment if one's a debunker by temperament.
All right. So why do you suppose the JFK assassination generated so many conspiracy theories?
Well, it had a lot of psychological resonance. To begin with, it had a lot of psychological resonance because Americans liked John Kennedy. He was widely admired. Even in Dallas, was a conservative city that went for Richard Nixon in 1960 big time. But when Kennedy came to Dallas in November of 1963, he was given a very, very warm welcome. It was the celebrity thing, the fact that he was young, that he was a glamorous president. When Malcolm X was assassinated, not that many people identified with Malcolm X. When George Wallace was shot, that was 1972, not that many people identified with or particularly liked George Wallace. But when Kennedy was shot, that was a different matter. It's also the case that the Kennedy assassination, if you look back on it historically, might seem like a kind of watershed, because in America, things seemed to go sour in the 60s after the Kennedy assassination. We had before had a civil rights movement that a majority of Americans could identify with. We began to have black militants like, Eldridge Cleaver and Stokely Carmichael and riots in the cities. The Vietnam War ramped up and was hugely divisive. So regardless of causation, that is, regardless of whether there was any causal connection between those things, people kind of remember it as sort of the beginning of America losing its innocence, in a sense.
Yeah. Remind us of some of the many different claims about the Kennedy assassination, conspiracy claims.
Oh, gosh, there are so many. I think one of the most important is that the single bullet theory would not work, and that the bullet would have had to zig and zag in midair to hit Kennedy and Connolly. And, of course, any of your listeners who saw the movie JFK saw a diagram with the bullet zigging and zagging in midair. Everybody who has seriously tried to plot the trajectory, that is, has seriously asked, where was Kennedy located in the limo, where was Connolly located in the limo, where was the school book depository relative to Kennedy and Connolly, has found that the trajectory through Kennedy hitting Connolly where he was hit, slightly right near his right shoulder, actually works out. It's a straight line. And in fact, last night on Nat Geo, you had a documentary that did the same thing again for about the fourth or fifth time. And so that is that's simply not true. Another classic piece of conspiracy lore is that there was a Grassy Knoll shooter. If you look carefully at the evidence of that, it's real, real thin at best. In the first place, the medical evidence clearly indicates that Kennedy was hit only twice from behind. If there was a Grassy Knoll shooter, the Grassy Knoll shooter missed. I mean, to give you an example, we have X-rays of Kennedy's skull taken at the autopsy. And there are no bullet fragments to the left of the center line in his skull. Now, the Grassy Knoll would have been to Kennedy's right, and had he been shot from the Grassy Knoll, he would have been hit from the right front. But there's no exit wound on the left side of Kennedy's head. There are not even any bullet fragments to the left of the center line. There is a trail of bullet fragments from the back of his head to... That goes forward pretty much to the eye socket. So all the medical evidence says he wasn't hit from the right front. And there's one very good witness named Lee Bowers, who was in a signal tower behind the stockade fence where the Grassy Knoll shooter would have had to be. And Bowers was actually paying some attention, apparently, and he didn't see any shooter. He did see a couple of guys behind the stockade fence, but he said they weren't together. They didn't appear to be together. He didn't see them doing anything suspicious, and at least one, was sure, stuck around after the shooting. That is to say, didn't head off, didn't flee, but just stuck around. Bowers didn't know about the other one because he said his clothing blended in with the foliage. Actually, Bowers' testimony would suggest that there simply was no Grassy Knoll shooter. But hey, it's such fun to have a Grassy Knoll shooter.
Right. So why do you suppose it is? We have a government investigation saying Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. We have, as you mentioned, four or five different pieces, investigations here. This most latest, the one that was on Nat Geo last night, saying, "Hey, it was just a single bullet." Why these conspiracy theories persist over the years?
Well, partly they're just more fun. I mean, it has become a parlor game. I've had people, if they find out I teach a course on the Kennedy assassination, they'll ask me, "Well, what's your theory?" And then I'll say, I think Oswald did it all by himself. And there'll be a look on their face that says, in effect, spoil sport. It's just not very interesting. It's not fun. It's also the case that you can get all kind of mileage out of conspiracy theories. For example, you can demonize your political enemies. There are a lot of conspiracy theorists who are on the political left. In general, this is sort of not what we might call the reputable left. I mean, The Nation magazine, has never endorsed conspiracy theories, but what I call kind of the scruffy left, people who don't like the CIA, don't like the FBI, didn't like them during the Cold War, and, hey, they can blame those agencies for killing Kennedy. Of course, on the other side, back in the 60s, the John Birch Society was distributing stickers. I actually have a picture of one of those stickers on my website that said, "Communism killed Kennedy." They weren't happy just to say that Oswald, who thought himself to be a Marxist and a socialist, that Oswald did it by himself. They wanted a conspiracy with a bunch of communists killing Kennedy. So you can get a lot of mileage out of that if you want to demonize some political enemies. So there are a variety of reasons.
So when we encounter conspiracy theories like this, how do you advocate we think about them? How should we approach them with logic?
Well, there are a lot of sort of principles I talk about in my book. One thing that it's fairly simple, but often you don't get it, is ask. Conspiracy theorists will parade in front of the reader a piece of evidence that contradicts the Warren Commission account of things. Excuse me, I have a cough this morning. At any rate, for example, there was a witness in the county records building right across, catty-corner across the street from the Texas School Book Depository. Her name was Lillian Mooneyham. She looked out one of the windows and saw a man in the sniper's nest, not standing near the window, so she couldn't recognize the man. And she said she saw a man in the sniper's nest about 4.5 or 5 minutes after the shots were fired. Now, Oswald had to be long gone by then. He would have been out the front door of the depository, headed up Elm Street to catch a bus at that time. The cops didn't arrive on the sixth floor in the sniper's nest until about 1 o'clock. Okay? So if she saw somebody 4.5 to 5 minutes after the shooting, gosh, it had to be a conspirator, didn't it? Now, you're not supposed to ask the question, wait a minute, do we really believe that a conspiracy shooter would shoot Kennedy and then just hang around in the sniper's nest for 4.5 or 5 minutes, just lollygag there, not flee or anything? That's terribly, terribly implausible, and I think it's pretty obvious she has to be mistaken about something, maybe about the timing, or maybe about the particular window in which she saw a man. So you've got to ask that kind of question. Does this particular piece of evidence fit a plausible scenario? And if it fits no plausible scenario, the witness is probably mistaken, or the bureaucrat who wrote that memo was probably clueless. And I have a good bit of fun in my manuscript, in my book, showing readers witness testimony that's just out there. It's just wild. It doesn't fit the Warren Commission version of events, and it doesn't fit any conspiracy theory either. All books, and this includes lone assassin books and conspiracy books, tend to stress witness testimony too much. What I tend to do is, in my book, is I talk a lot about the fallibility of witness testimony. It's almost never the best evidence. You have to be rather skeptical of witness testimony, and when you're properly skeptical, Lillian Mooneyham's account is, you have to kind of write it off because you've seen so many errors and so many mistakes from witnesses. You know, this is pretty normal and pretty common.
We are talking with John McAdams. He's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He is author of JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. And we're talking about how we can use critical thinking to determine the truth or not of some of these claims about the Kennedy assassination, or for that matter, other conspiracy theories surrounding things like 9/11 and was the U.S. government involved, or how about FDR and Pearl Harbor? Did he know ahead of time? The 1969 moon landing and others. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
That was Walter Cronkite announcing the death, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 48 years ago tomorrow. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the assassination of JFK, and we are taking a look at the conspiracy theories surrounding that tragedy with a guest who is debunking many of them and saying how they can provide valuable lessons in critical thinking. John McAdams is the author of JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or a claim you would like to bring up, or you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And lots of calls coming in, Professor McAdams. But before we go to the phones, I'm just wondering, after, you know, four or five different documentaries like the one that was on the Nat Geo channel last night, saying that Oswald acted alone. Are those who believe otherwise ever going to change their mind, or will they just keep on believing?
Oh gosh, that's difficult to say, I'm not a prophet. You can make some wild speculation as to what people will think about this 200 years hence, what the history books will report, whether there'll still be a kind of active conspiracy culture, people writing conspiracy books and documentaries on places like the History Channel, promoting the idea of conspiracy. And it is, and it's very difficult to know. I know that, for example, where Abraham Lincoln is concerned, there was clearly a conspiracy there. But the issue is, were there more conspirators than were ever discovered? So people still debate that, and that's a lot farther removed from us, maybe almost 100 years further removed than the JFK assassination. So this is going to have a long life.
Yeah. Robert in Middleton is our first caller. Hello, Robert.
Good morning.
Morning.
The part about the JFK assassination that always caused me to question the lone shooter or lone conspirator idea was Jack Ruby's killing of Oswald. And Jack Ruby, well, wasn't he a person who had connections to organized crime? And didn't Jack Ruby maintain silence about why he killed Oswald to his very last dying day as he was in prison?
Okay, a couple of things. Did he have ties to mob figures? Yes, he most certainly did. He had a lot of ties to mob figures. By the way, he also had a lot of ties to law enforcement and a lot of ties to the local media. I mean, he knew the reporters. I guess from one perspective, those are all the same thing. He was sort of a gatecrasher and a busybody. He knew about everybody. He knew lots and lots of people in Dallas, cops, media people, and he knew, for example, he was a good buddy of Joey Campese, a mob figure in Dallas. Does that mean that he silenced Oswald on behalf of the mob? If you actually look carefully at Jack Ruby, he wasn't the sort of person that the mob, to whom the mob would entrust any kind of serious hit or any kind of serious business at all. Jack Ruby was a notorious suck-up and a notorious blabbermouth. He just wasn't the type you'd trust to be a hitman. As for his remaining silent, he did not at all. He gave multiple explanations of why he shot Oswald, some of which contradicted the others. For example, he said he did it so that Mrs. Kennedy would not have to return to Dallas for a Lee Harvey Oswald trial. He said he did it because somebody needed to, and you folks, he's talking to the cops, couldn't do it. He said he did it to show that the Jews have guts, as though the Israeli army hadn't proven that perfectly well by that point. So he gave several explanations, different ones, somewhat contradictory. His addled brain produced a lot of different explanations. One thing he was perfectly consistent about was insisting that he wasn't part of any conspiracy. Early on, in his Warren Commission testimony, which is typically misrepresented badly in conspiracy books, and I show how that's the case in my book, he wanted it to be taken to Washington, D.C., not to confess his role in a conspiracy, but to try to convince Lyndon Johnson that he was innocent. He didn't like it that he was talking to the Warren Commission, which was Johnson's representatives. He wanted to talk to the top guy and convince Lyndon Johnson personally that he was innocent, or at least that's what he told the Warren Commission. Later on, he read a book while he was in prison, read a book called A Texan Looks at Lyndon, and decided that Lyndon Johnson was part of the conspiracy. This wasn't because he had any inside knowledge. If he had any inside knowledge and Johnson was a member of the conspiracy, he would have known that from point zero. He just read a book, and like a lot of Americans, reached a particular conclusion. I think it is important to understand the real Jack Ruby. He thought he was going to be a hero. He thought that he would get kind of a slap on the wrist and go to Chicago and be a famous restaurateur or something like that. And he was somewhat shocked when not only did he not get patted on the back, but he was convicted by Dallas DA Henry Wade of murder with malice, which is a Texas term for first-degree murder, and sentenced to be executed. He got out of that on, his lawyers got him out of that on appeal, but he just badly miscalculated that.
Speaking of President Johnson or LBJ and whether he was a part of a conspiracy, do you know, Professor McAdams, if those long-lost recordings from Air Force One that were in the news recently shed any more light on that?
I haven't actually been able to listen to them. I haven't even been able to dig them up. At some point, they'll doubtless be online and everyone can listen. I would very much doubt it because a lot of Air Force One recordings are have been available a long time, and what they show is sort of routine, you know, air traffic. So I would doubt there's anything in there. I mean, let's put it this way: if there was a conspiracy, would anyone on Air Force One know about it? Well, I guess that's possible, but I don't think it's likely. So I think the odds are very, very low that there's any kind of a real evidence, either conspiracy or, for that matter, evidence to convict Oswald on those tapes.
We're talking with John McAdams. He is author of JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. And our next caller is Todd in Trevor. Hello, Todd. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess my question for you is, there's a speech that a lot of conspiracy theorists kind of, you know, use as evidence, where John F. Kennedy talks about secret societies and things like that, things of that nature. And then, of course, he's assassinated. And I wonder what your, you know, if you could talk about that a little bit and, you know, how that kind of comes into play and stuff. So,
Society speech?
Yeah, I've heard about that. I haven't actually read the speech. Secret societies wouldn't be a term used to apply to, say, the CIA or the FBI. You know, I doubt he would have said anything bad about the Masons, for example, which is clearly a secret society and doesn't make any bones about being a secret society. That would not have been good politics. So I frankly don't know what that was, but I do know that a phrase like secret society would not have been applied to the CIA, to the FBI, or even to the mafia. It would have been called the mob, or for a while it was called La Casa Nostra, which is a somewhat odd term. But I'm frankly at a loss. I'd have to go back and read that speech to know how to interpret it. But that kind of phraseology would not have been used about something like the CIA or the FBI. Could it have been the Klan? I don't know. I'd have to go back and read the speech. I'm afraid I have to opt out of that. Yeah.
Todd, thank you very much. Luba in Madison is with us now. Hello, Luba.
Good morning. I listened to somebody who spoke about the Oswald assassination after the event occurred, and he didn't believe that Oswald did it, number one. And number two, he said he tried to get on the radio stations and TV, and they wouldn't let him on. And my observation is, last year, I watched a TV program where it had Oswald going into the station, and a reporter in the background said, "Oswald, did you kill the president?" And Oswald said, "No, I didn't kill anybody." Now, that's a very strange remark for someone who would kill someone, and so immediately.
All right. So you think because he said, "I didn't kill anybody," that I don't know, is that odd that somebody accused of a murder would deny doing it, Professor McAdams? I'm sorry.
No, I didn't kill him, or something of that effect. But this was very naively, I didn't kill anybody.
Yeah, and for some reason we lost our connection with John McAdams, so we will get him back. Luba, hang on. We will maybe have you repeat your question or your story when we get him back. And in the meantime, let me remind you that you can call in if you have a question about the different conspiracy theories, especially surrounding the JFK assassination. We welcome them at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe you have another another event that is surrounded by conspiracy theories as well. Our guest can talk with us on how we should think about these different claims and use critical thinking when we hear these types of claims. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you. She will be welcoming in a guest to talk about the latest news from Wisconsin and from Washington, D.C. She will be holding her All Things Political Hour, as always, after 9 o'clock on Monday. Later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. As the deadline looms for the Congressional Supercommittee to agree on $1.2 trillion in savings, Ben and his guest will discuss the various plans being proposed and the prospect of a deal being struck. That's this afternoon during At Issue with Ben Marins after 4 o'clock. Speaking of the Supercommittee and whether or not a deal will be struck, it's looking more and more like no is the answer to that. We will talk with a guest tomorrow morning between 7 and 8 about the very latest in terms of the super committee and whether any deal has been made or not. And what next if one isn't? What's going to happen now? That's tomorrow between 7 and 8. Also tomorrow between 8 and 9, we will have another edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be here, as he is just about every Tuesday between 8 and 9, to talk with you about your money, On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Oh, we have We have reestablished contact with our guest. John McAdams is the author of JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. And Professor McAdams, did you hear Luba say, what about Lee Harvey Oswald telling a reporter in that famous footage when he was being led from jail just before he got shot by Jack Ruby, that he was asked, did you kill anyone or why did you kill the president? And he said, I didn't kill anyone.
Well, yeah, he absolutely denied being guilty either the murder of Kennedy or Tippett. Interestingly, he propounded a theory, Oswald did, of why he had been arrested. You know, he didn't say, Mr. E. Howard Hunt told me to meet him in the second floor lunchroom. He said, they're taking me in because I've been in the Soviet Union. In other words, he portrayed himself as a kind of a patsy of opportunity, that someone shot the president and they need to arrest somebody, and they found out, they being Dallas authorities, that he'd been in the Soviet Union and picked him up for that reason. Murderers often don't admit that they did it. It is true that some political murderers will admit that they did it, but Oswald didn't. I think he really liked playing the victim. Remember, he'd been politicized as a teenager with the Julius and Ethel Rosenberg case, two atomic spies that had been convicted of espionage and sentenced to death. Now, Oswald probably believed that they were innocent, but he would have noted that they got a huge amount of mileage, and their supporters got a huge amount of mileage out of saying that that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were victims, victims of a capitalist society, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Luba, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I still think that the fellow was young, he was confused, he was naive, and the way he said it, they said, did you kill the president? And he said, no, I didn't kill anybody or anyone, anybody. And that's just a very, I don't know, I can't imagine any killer saying that.
You can't imagine it. All right. Well, Luba just heard you explain that a little bit and still, we just can't imagine a killer would say that. So how should she think about this particular claim of conspiracy?
Oh, my. Well, a lot of killers say they didn't kill anybody. It's not that uncommon. I don't take Oswald's word as being particularly strong evidence.
Saul in Stevens Point. Hello, Saul.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if this is a conspiracy or anything, but I was a student in Chicago in the 60s, and I remember the day that Ruby shot Oswald. In the morning papers, or it might have been the night before, they published the route. They had a picture and showed the route from the jail to the courthouse that Oswald was going to be transported on. And I said at the time to my friend, I said, they're trying to kill him. Now, who released that kind of information probably knew there's more than one nut left in Dallas to, you know, to bump off Ruby. I'm sorry, to bump off Oswald.
Sure.
So I don't think Ruby was in particular. There are probably four or five other guys waiting to do the same thing.
Yeah, so publishing the route.
Well, a couple of things. Ruby just barely made it in time to bump off Oswald. He had awakened on a Sunday morning after the time that Oswald was supposed to be transferred. Oswald was supposed to be transferred at 10 a.m., got a call from one of his strippers. Remember, he ran a strip club, who needed some money to pay her rent, so he went to the Western Union office and wired her some money. She was in Fort Worth, and then apparently walked right down the block. It's, you know, half a block from where the Western Union office is to the basement entrance to the police station. Apparently evaded an officer who was supposed to stop everybody but was distracted directing traffic and walked right down the ramp, arriving somewhere between 30 seconds and a minute before it was time to do the job. So it looks for all the world like an accident. As for revealing information, you've got to understand that the Dallas authorities were very cooperative with the press. Among other things, they knew that the Northeastern press and the European press pretty much stereotyped people in Dallas as a bunch of rednecks who might beat up a suspect or might violate Oswald's civil liberties. And so they wanted the press to be able to see Oswald. I mean, that explains the near midnight press conference on Friday night when Oswald was paraded out to address and talk to a lot of the gathered press. They wanted the press to, it's what today we call transparency. You know, it's not a good idea when you have someone that somebody might want to shoot, but that was their general mindset. They wanted the press to see what was happening. They wanted to accommodate the press. That was naive on their part, but look, they'd never had a prisoner like that before. So with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, no, you don't let any reporters into the basement. There were guards posted that were supposed to keep out everybody, but accredited reporters, it didn't work. With 20/20 hindsight, I'm sure pretty much any police force today would be much more careful with somebody accused of shooting the president.
Thank you, Saul. Todd in Comstock has another question about Oswald's shooting. Hi, Todd.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I guess, you know, I've looked at this. I was a very young boy, and I mean, I was very saddened by this happening. And as I grew older, I read many, many books, and I'm sure there's all kinds of books that have a lot of misinformation and a lot that's copied from public record. But a couple of things come to mind here. One is that, you know, it's not exactly a secret that when the mob does a hit, if they want to silence the hitter, they have somebody to back that up, to take him out, so that there's no way in hell it's going to come back on him. And on that day, when he did the hit on the on Kennedy, and personally, I don't think he did it. I have no belief in it at all.
And just why? Why? Okay. Why are you okay. So adamant that he didn't do it?
Well, let me tell you this part. And well, because for one thing, the distance, the timing, the whole bit. I mean, it's just so easy to make this guy a patsy by leaving a gun up there. To have had fired around out of that, have a gun, you know, had been fired recently, you know, so you could tell that the gun had been fired. There's nobody that has ever said that there was a round fired from that rifle that they can match up ballistically to the wounds, because the bullets were stolen, the brain was stolen from Kennedy when they took him to the hospital at Bethesda when they flew him from Parkland. But with that said, the day that he killed him, I believe that there was a person waiting to shoot Oswald when he came out of that depository, or why he was still in there. But when he took off, he got by whoever was going to do it, and when it was found out that he was on the run, he ran into Officer Tippett when he was going to go to this movie theater. And I believe that Tippett was the person hired by the mob to take him out. Oswald must have been hip to who this guy was. He took him out, and that activated Ruby to take him out.
Wow, Todd. So why would someone be ready to take out Oswald, shoot him when he left the school book depository, if Oswald didn't do it?
Well, because if someone else, well, first of all, in more recent times, I wish I had the source, but in the last 5 years, they came up with the fact that there was a three-man hit team hired from France that came here that was spread out all over, including in a manhole on the path of the president that day. But the reason that they would do it is real simple. If somebody else shot him and it could come up with anything, any way of proving, you know, well, 5 minutes before this, I was this, and it raised reasonable doubt, it's going to start getting them to look elsewhere.
I get it. And Todd, I appreciate your calling in with all of these different elements here. Professor McAdams, what about all those things? A lot of mystery around this, it sounds like. Did we lose our guest again? I don't know what's going on. This is getting a little bit aggravating, but we will try to get John McAdams back, and we'll try to somehow lock that phone down so we don't lose it again. And we'll take a short break, and then we'll ask John McAdams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University and author of JFK Assassination Logic, How to Think About Claims of Conspiracy. We'll have him respond to Todd's call, and we'll take more of yours at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Talking about this in part because tomorrow is the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and it's also our guest says providing some valuable lessons in critical thinking if we put some logical thinking to these conspiracy theories. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
A single bullet now has to account for the remaining 7 wounds in Kennedy and Conley. But rather than admit to a conspiracy or investigate further, the Warren Commission chose to endorse the theory put forth by an ambitious junior counselor, Arlen Specter, one of the grossest lies ever forced on the American people. We've come to know it as the magic bullet theory.
That is Kevin Costner in the movie Oliver Stone's well-known movie JFK. Here he is laying out the magic bullet theory in the assassination of JFK. We're talking about the various claims of conspiracy surrounding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy with John McAdams, who is the author of JFK Assassination Logic. Before we address Todd's call, Professor McAdams, you think Oliver Stone's movie was instrumental in giving a boost to the conspiracy theorists when it comes to JFK's assassination?
Well, I think it was. It's an extremely well-made movie. It's about 3 hours. I require my students in my JFK assassination course to watch the movie, and just to get them immersed in assassination lore. Then, you know, we spend a semester trying to sort it out. But it's 3 hours, but they never complain.
Yeah.
Because it actually maintains your interest for 3 hours. It's an exceedingly well-made movie. Of course, not merely, you know, every two sentences, but almost every sentence is inaccurate or misrepresents something. But there's no doubt it's a compelling movie, and a lot of the people who watch it will simply accept it and not bother to go ask the questions. Hey, is this the truth or not?
You know, I don't want to go into, because we're now running short on time and lots of different callers to go into great detail of Todd's specific theory. But if you caught some of that, your reaction?
Well, I didn't get much of it. I keep getting cut off, which I think must be
a conspiracy. What's going on here?
I don't know. We haven't had trouble with this phone, but I understand you haven't had trouble with your phone.
No, no. This is very unusual. Yeah.
Well, briefly, what did Todd say?
Well, he did say it's first of all, it's not uncommon. It's very well known that the mob will silence the hitter if they have somebody do a hit. So that was because that happens. That's what happened.
Well, except that here's the problem. You trade if Oswald was the guy who performed the mob hit on Kennedy, you trade in custody one tight-lipped guy who was uncooperative and didn't like to talk with one blabbermouth who liked to talk all the time, who had a history of sucking up to every kind of official under the sun, including justices of the peace. At one point on Friday night, he found someone was a justice of the peace at Dallas Police Headquarters, and he was very impressed by that. He had a history of being a huge suck-up to law enforcement. So if you're going to have somebody in custody, way better to have Oswald in custody than to have Jack Ruby in custody.
Yeah, and he said that he thinks that Officer, is it Tippett, Todd thought he was there to hit the hitman in killing Oswald, but Oswald, he thinks, was onto that, so killed Tippett first.
Well, I don't know how to refute that, except that Tippett, there's actually an essay on my website about Tippett's activities, and if you look at the police radio traffic, the dispatcher to Tippett, it really looks like Tippett was just a cop who was told to be on patrol at large, the dispatcher said, in Oak Cliff, nothing looks suspicious about that. I'm not sure you can absolutely refute that theory, but there's no evidence of it. It's pure speculation.
Yeah. Well, we're going to Ray in Milwaukee has been waiting, and he takes us to another conspiracy theory. Ray in Milwaukee, go ahead.
Sure. First, I'd just like to say about 9/11 truth that we're all painted with a single brush, and there are many shades of beliefs in the 9/11 truth as to what actually took place. And I just want to hear Professor McAdams' logical answer to these two statements that come directly from 9/11 Commission report. At 8:20 that morning was the first call to Northeastern Air Defense, and they were alerted that a hijacking was happening. It was 9:37 when the plane hit the Pentagon. They still had not set up jet fighters. Now, that is completely against standard U.S. Air Force protocol. And the second point is the live feed that day from BBC TV in the afternoon, 5 in the afternoon, when Tower 7 collapsed, 20 minutes before it collapsed, they said, Tower 7 has just collapsed. And when it did collapse, Mr. McAdams, it collapsed not because the fire protective coating on the steel had been knocked off by any airplanes. No airplanes had hit that building. It was a steel frame building, 50 stories tall, and it crimped from the center and collapsed in a standard demolition. It was perfect demolition technique, Tower 7. Now, logically answer both of those questions.
Sure. I'm not necessarily a big expert on 9/11 theories because I mostly talk about the Kennedy assassination because a lot of the principles about this Kennedy assassination apply to other conspiracy theories. Here's an interesting thing about Building 7, World Trade Center. I did an actual content analysis of how much attention the media played to 7, World Trade Center. It was not very much noticed. The amount of coverage gotten by the collapse of the Twin Towers was huge, but Tower 7 was a sideshow. So it seems very difficult to understand why conspirators would want to bring down Tower 7 when it was barely mentioned in the media at the time. It's now a big deal for 9/11 truthers, but it was barely mentioned at the time. Now, as for having the jet fighters up, you've got to understand that these fighters are part of the military. That's a kind of a hangover from the Cold War. Their whole orientation is that somebody might send a bomber over the North Pole and try to bomb the United States. They're really more oriented toward external threats and always have been than a hijacked airplane. The idea that someone might hijack an airplane and use it as a cruise missile to attack a building was not utterly unheard of, but it was close to being unheard of before 9/11. Before that, when people hijacked airplanes, they would land them somewhere, hold the passengers hostages, and make demands using an airplane as a cruise missile. Simply wasn't part of people's way of thinking about it. Now, I've seen sources that say that that possibility had been raised, but I don't think it had penetrated the, I forget the part of the Air Force that protects us against Russian bombers coming over the pole, but I don't think it had penetrated their organizational structure, their doctrine, their way of thinking.
Thank you very much, Ray, for the call. Well, you know, 9/11 being a so-called inside job and the JFK assassination have to be two of the biggest sources of conspiracy theories. Are there others that that come to mind when you know, talking about the claims of conspiracy that you at least address briefly in the book?
Well, I mean, I have one chapter on, for example, you always want to go with the most reliable evidence. For example, conspiracy books will often produce witness testimony about John Kennedy's wounds, and you can get witness testimony easily that contradicts the Warren Commission version. The best evidence, of course, is the autopsy photos and x-rays. Now, I also deal a little bit with Barack Obama's birth certificate, which was a big issue. Now, what's the most reliable evidence on that? Well, not the computer-printed birth certificate that he produced during the 2008 campaign, not even the vault copy that he produced a few months ago. Those kinds of documents can be forged. The best evidence is the birth notices in the Honolulu newspapers on the day it may have been the day after he was born, but with a birth date that corresponds with his birth certificate. Those birth notices appeared in the two Honolulu papers. Now, to believe that's fake, you've got to believe some conspirator somehow located all the microfilm copies of the two Honolulu newspapers and managed to somehow fake or forge those birth notices in the microfilm copies of those papers. So far and away, the most reliable evidence is those birth notices, which that's been known a long time, and that should settle the issue to the satisfaction. That should have long ago settled the issue to everyone's satisfaction.
Well, Professor McAdams, we're just about out of time. We have full lines with people who have specific items regarding JFK's assassination that they wanted to present to you. We don't have time to do them. What should they do to, I don't know, to think about these claims of conspiracy?
Well, read my book would be one thing. Buy it and read it. Checking out my website would be another thing to do, which is jfkassassination.net. At least that's the easiest way to get to, simply jfkassassination.net. By the way, I have links to a bunch of other websites, including the best or most extensive conspiracy websites on my website. So, you know, dive in and start looking around. There is also, for people who want to do something really interesting, something called the Mary Farrell Foundation, which is www.maryfarrell, Farrell with two R's, two E's, and two L's, F-E-R-R-E-L-L, maryfarrellfoundation.org, that has a huge number of resources. It's a conspiracy-oriented site, so some of the essays on it aren't too reliable, but it has a huge number of primary source documents.
Mm-hmm.
You do real history from primary sources, not because primary sources are perfect or always right. It's just that's the way you do real history if you want to get beyond what some author chose to show you.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a good time indeed.
John McAdams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. His book is JFK Assassination Logic. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.